The show is live and local. It's your connection to local performances. Coming up, a conversation with artists involved in the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra concert tomorrow night, specifically photographic artists Larry Canfer and Carol Wackerlin. On the program is Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, which was inspired by paintings back in the 1800s. And there's a reimagining of the presentation, anyway, of Pictures at an Exhibition with some of their work. Steve Larson, who's the music director and conductor, will join us as well. First up, though, a conversation with Lauren Sklamberg, who is lead vocalist, one of the founding members as well, of the Klezmatics, who are coming to the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts on Saturday for a concert at 7:30. Klezmatics play klezmer music as well as other kinds of things, as you'll hear in just a couple of seconds here, a few seconds. They consider themselves really purveyors of various types of Jewish roots music, and we'll have several examples of their work from their most recent CD, which is actually taken from a concert of a while ago, and from Town Hall in New York City. Live at Town Hall is the name of the album, and this is music. Remember I said klezmer band, but with a twist. It's music set to lyrics, or setting lyrics, by Woody Guthrie, and this is called Holy Ground.
Take off your shoes. This place, every spot I walk, it's holy ground.
This was called Holy Ground from the Live at Town Hall CD by the Klezmatics, who are coming to the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts on Saturday for a 7:30 show. They're still apparently the only klezmer band to win a Grammy Award, which somehow seems incredible. On the phone with me right now is Lauren Sklamberg, who is lead vocalist and one of the founding members of the Klezmatics. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So this live album, although it's your newest, actually comes from a performance that was given, almost six years ago?
2006.
At New York's Town Hall. Did it just take a while to get it done?
Yeah, as you can imagine, there were somewhere around 30 people on stage, at the biggest moments. So sorting out who was where and what they were doing and that sort of thing took a while. And also, if you know anything about the band, you know that we all don't make our living from the band, so we're all kind of scrambling around to get to stay afloat. So it just took time for it to happen for us to finish it. I mean, I should say it took time for me to finish it because I produced the recording together with our friend who is the engineer on it.
The tune that we heard, Holy Ground, does that. I know you have a recent documentary called The Klezmatics on Holy Ground. Was that named for this song, or this song comes out of there, or what's the connection?
Oh, no, the title of the film comes from this song, and from, in a larger sense, from the project we did with the lyrics of Woody Guthrie.
Yeah, which when I read that, it was pretty surprising because I don't think of klezmer bands doing songs of Woody Guthrie, at least lyrics of Woody Guthrie. How did that come about?
Well, we met Nora Guthrie many years ago when we were playing with Yitzhak Perlman at the Tanglewood Music Festival, and she told us that her father had written some Hanukkah songs, which I sort of knew about, but what people generally don't realize is that Woody Guthrie spent more of his life in Brooklyn and in New York than he spent anywhere else, including, you know, people think of him as the Dust Bowl balladeer, but he really, you know, spent most of his life in Brooklyn. So he had written all these songs in Coney Island, and he also had this wonderful relationship with his mother-in-law, who was a Yiddish poet and songwriter and political activist. So they kind of influenced each other. And in Woody, what that meant was that he wrote these Jewish holiday songs, including songs for Hanukkah, and also, you know, that there's a lot of songs about the cultural life in Coney Island and in Brooklyn. So, you know, Nora had been working with Billy Bragg and Wilco and doing the Mermaid Avenue recordings with them, and so she wanted to take these lyrics that her father had written that didn't have surviving music and have them be given new life by people, you know, putting music to his words. So that's basically how we ended up doing this.
And do you give it would you say you give it a klezmer that you would still call what you're doing with his lyrics klezmer music, or is this one of your ways of branching out?
I generally don't call what we do klezmer music. We started out, you know, playing, music from the klezmer repertoire, from the wedding repertoire, the instrumental music, and, you know, to that, of course, we added Yiddish songs, but then, you know, we sort of kind of expanded, you know, the vocabulary and the scope of what we were doing. So, you know, you could loosely call us a klezmer band, but you know, we basically were given the freedom on this to go wherever we wanted musically. So, you know, so it's all kind of all over the map. And it still sounds like us. I mean, the thing is that we kind of try to infuse everything we do with you know, some flavor of Yiddish music in some way. And so, you know, I wouldn't say that we tried to make, you know, klezmer Guthrie kind of a klezmer Guthrie kind of thing. Some of the songs, you know, very definitely sound like that, and some of them don't.
Well, let's hear another song from the live album. This one's called St. John's Niggin, and which begs the first question: what is a niggin? Which is spelled N-I-G-N.
A niggin is a wordless tune. The term is used in the Hasidic world, and it means these sorts of songs that are spiritual in nature, and that don't need words. They just have syllables that you sing, like die 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 or ma 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 or these sorts of things. And you know, it's basically considered a more direct communication with God and the spiritual realm. So this was a tune that I wrote. And funny enough, the reason it's called St. John's Niggin, which is, you know, kind of, you know, what's that? You know, there's a beautiful cathedral in New York City called the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, and a friend of ours who was the organist there was doing a recording project to benefit the organ there and to do a restoration project on the organ. So we recorded a medley of songs for that, and this was written for that project. So that's why it's called St. John's Niggin.
Fair enough. And it's performed by the Klezmatics, who will be at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts Saturday evening at 7:30. And we're talking with founding member Lawrence Glamberg here on Live and Local. I The music was called St. John's Niggin, and it comes from the Live at Town Hall CD, which is the most recent recording project by the Klezmatics, who will be in Bloomington Saturday night. I'm talking with Lawrence Glamberg, who is lead vocalist, accordionist, guitarist, pianist with the band. And the as I'm looking through the member list here and the instruments that you all play, I do see what I think of as, anyway, as the typical klezmer instruments, which would be, I guess, accordion, trumpet, clarinet, violin. And I'm guessing this one instrument, though I'm not sure exactly what it is, cymbal? It sounds like a cymbal. Is it just a Yiddish way of spelling cymbal?
No, no. Although it is a percussion instrument, in the way that a piano is a percussion instrument, it is what we would call in English a hammered dulcimer, and it exists it was one of the quintessential instruments in the old country for playing Yiddish music, and you see pictures or paintings of klezmorim in Eastern Europe, and you, usually there'll be a violin, a bass, and a cymbal, or maybe a drummer, perhaps. But that was kind of the traditional trio of instruments, in fact, it's mentioned in a famous song as the Yiddish version of Old King Cole. Those of your listeners who are familiar with that song, with Rebbe Elimelech, would know that the rabbi gets so merry and he sends for his fiddlers and he sends for his drummers and then he sends for his cymblers. So those aren't people who play cymbals, like drum cymbals. Those are people who play the cymbal. And if you could have three cymblers, then you were actually probably pretty well off if you could afford to have three people who played that instrument. So that's what that is, and it's a distinctly old world sound that's become part of our arsenal of sounds that we have in our band.
And to complete people's education here, that is spelled T-S-I-M-B-L. Cymbal. And then there's, what's this other instrument, K-A-V-A-L, Kaval?
Kaval is a Bulgarian flute that Matt, our clarinetist, plays. And it's another sound that's kind of unique to our band as far as klezmer music goes. And it's kind of a melancholy, very airy sort of sounding flute. And we use it a lot for different kinds of flavors.
You said earlier that you don't really consider yourselves quite a klezmer band, which I suppose begs the question, what is a klezmer band, and then what are you?
Well, it's kind of hard to say these days because you know, you can say that people play klezmer, and then people have an idea in their heads what that is. At least now people have an idea about what that is. It's like, you know, when we first started playing this music, people didn't necessarily know what klezmer music was. But it was like you were saying, that people think of like the quintessential klezmer instruments, specifically clarinet and violin. I think violin is much more kind of a European part of the European tradition, European Jewish tradition, and the clarinet is much more of an American or more contemporary innovation. And so what people think of as klezmer music now really is an American, a hybrid American form, the way that Tex-Mex or Zydeco or Cajun music are. It really is like this kind of brash Jewish American music. We're definitely part of, in a general sense, we're definitely part of that tradition, and definitely, you know, we can play a dance, a klezmer dance set, as well as anyone. We have gone where our hearts take us, and where, interesting projects have taken us. So that's why I said, in a general sense, we're a klezmer band, but we kind of do a little bit of a lot of things.
Well, Jewish roots band is a term that I see in your bio, and that sounds
that
sounds as good as anything.
I like that.
I know when I've always enjoyed klezmer music, and I've run into plenty of people who still don't know what that means, mm-hmm. at least to hear the name, although they'll recognize the sound. So when I started to listen to your music, I thought, oh, well, that's kind of klezmer. But then I wrote at the beginning of one of the songs I was listening to, it sounds like the Twilight Zone, mm-hmm. when it opened up. Others, which would be, sort of a typical Yiddish lament, I guess, some of the, mm-hmm. one of the niggins that I heard elsewhere, and some sort of a different sort of drama in some of the songs than I've heard in the typical klezmer band, klezmer music. Mm-hmm. And I note that you also have worked into your own aesthetic a certain, as you call it here, a consistent and coherent political and aesthetic Yiddish/klezmer music.
Mm-hmm.
How does that figure in, the political side?
I think that one of the things we discovered early on was that we felt most comfortable playing songs, if we're going to do songs with words, that we felt most comfortable doing material that we believe in. And, as part of the idea of us being, whole musicians, and part of us like really expressing ourselves, who we are as humans through our music, part of that is, wasn't really, for instance, performing material from the Yiddish theater repertoire, which a lot of bands do, and which actually we used to do when we first started, but a lot of those kinds of like sentimental romanticized ideas of what the old country was like, it wasn't something, it was something that there were people who perform that sort of music that they do very well, and it wasn't something that we could, for various reasons, could do particularly well. But what we could do well is find ways of performing songs that said something that we wanted to say. So, we gravitated towards things like labor songs and things that are about making the world a better place. If we were going to perform, a spiritual material, it would be things that said something that was. By and large universal, like the songs about that are about the coming of a time of peace, for instance. Then there were things like doing original songs or reinterpreting older love songs to reflect who we are as people. In our case, that would mean that we would have some songs that had a homoerotic element to them, so that's what that means, and that's what that is sort of what we've been doing, and when we first started doing that, people would talk about these things in a concert. If people were at a concert by Pete Seeger or, say, Joan Baez or someone from the American folk world, who would talk about these things in the show, people wouldn't bat an eye because it's like you know, people expect them to do that. But when we were doing it, it was sort of, you know, people were sort of a little bit, you know, would do a maybe do a double take, you know. But we've been doing this for a long time now, so, you know, now it's like no one is surprised about this, about these kinds of things anymore. You know, that was something that was, you know, especially early on, that was very exciting and very meaningful, you know, for us to do. And now it's like, I feel like, you know, now that we've sort of proven ourselves that way, it's like, I feel like I can, you know, do anything.
And you can go hear them do anything that they want on Saturday's concert by the Klezmatics at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. It starts at 7:30. And you can get tickets by going to their website, which is, well, you can get to it. The way I get to it is just Google Arts Blooming. Actually, you can go to artsblooming.org. And you'll find the Bloomington Cultural District page, and then go to Main Stage Events, and you will find information. You'll find a little video of the Klezmatics there, and how to buy tickets as well. My guest on this portion of Live and Local has been Lauren Sklamberg, who is one of the founding members of the group and also the lead vocalist. And we're hearing excerpts from their Live at Town Hall CD. Going out with one here, this is a medley. I love the name of it, Rhythm and Jews with Horns. Want to explain that one?
So what that is that it combines songs from two of our CDs, Rhythm and Jews and Jews with Horns. One of the things we played around with was you know, kind of clever, you know, punny CD titles. So those are kind of a little you know, pair of CDs that had related titles. So we sort of thought another pun was to put the two of those titles together, you know, for this medley. And those actually feature he was our third clarinet player, David Krakauer, who recorded, three CDs with us and toured with us. And so he was in the Town Hall concert. So those feature him. And, big fun. I mean, the first song in that medley, Funtashlich, is the song that kind of, it was the first song on Rhythm and Jews. And it kind of announced to the world that, you know, what we were about and where we were going to go with this music. And people who had heard our first CD, you know, were kind of in for a bit of a surprise, because we kind of had moved on and grown up, were, you know, doing something new and interesting with the music.
Grown up and grown out. It sounds like the Klezmatics on Live and Local on FM 90.9. It's a medley of music that comes sort of combined from two CDs. One is called Rhythm and Jews, and the other is called Jews with Horns by the Klezmatics. This recording actually came off of their Live at Town Hall CD, which is their most recent one, and recorded at Town Hall in New York City. Klezmatics will be at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts tomorrow night. I'm sorry, what is today? Today is Thursday. Saturday night at 7:30. For more information, go to artsblooming.org. And on the Klezmatics, I think it's just theklezmatics.com or something like that, but you can certainly find them easily enough. Heard it on Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly. Our broadcast today is made possible with support from these business partners: Birch Tree Counseling and Consulting Champaign, Common Ground Food Co-op Urbana, Prairie Boatworks Gallery of Champaign, and Lowell Heap Farm of Dewey. These business partners join the Friends of WYLL in making great programs possible, and we thank you for your support. Stay tuned next for a conversation with two photographic artists whose work will be displayed, or rather projected, during a performance by the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra tomorrow night at the Krannert Center in Urbana. The opening music to Modest Mussorgsky's symphonic suite called Pictures at an Exhibition, or originally entitled Pictures from an Exhibition. I guess it depends how you translate it from the Russian. A Remembrance of Victor Hartmann, a suite in 10 movements, originally also written for piano, for that matter. In 1874, Victor Hartmann died just the year before that, lived a short life, about 40 years. He was a friend of Mussorgsky's, also an architect. And Mussorgsky, there have been a number of composers who have adapted or transcribed the piano original for orchestra, most famously Maurice Ravel. And I believe it's the Ravel orchestration that the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra will be using when they play this piece tomorrow night on a concert called Moving Pictures. On the first half of the concert, there are some music from films and also a pictographic suite of sorts called the National Park Suite of Michael Horwood. Concert starts at 7:30 at the Krannert Center in Urbana. Steve Larson is the music director and conductor. And Pictures in an Exhibition will not involve Victor Hartmann's original drawings or paintings, but it will involve some much newer photographs from two local artists, Larry Canfer and Carol Wackerlin. Steve Larson, Larry, and Carol are all with us here on Live and Local this half hour. Thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
So, Steve, you've been on here many times before. I'll just start with you. Was this your idea for this collaboration?
Yes. We did something like this in Rockford a couple years ago, and it was such a huge success that decided to do it down here. You mentioned the Victor Hartmann paintings, drawings, things like that. Several of them are lost, which is probably a pretty good thing because the ones that are extant really aren't very interesting.
I've noticed that when I've seen them
so,
before.
I'm kind of glad that they're not all here. In a way, the idea of doing a photo choreography is a little bit like doing the piece in reverse. Mussorgsky was inspired by the exhibit of drawings and etchings and sculpture and things like that to write the piece. We're taking the opposite tack. We're using the music as an inspiration for an assemblage of photographs that are put together in a DVD format, which is played while the orchestra is performing the piece. And of course, the music needs to be synchronized to the sequence of the photographs. And of course, that's where the conductor comes in.
Well, that's partly where the conductor comes in. One of the things you just showed me before we came on here, a nice little segment of the pictures, because I hadn't seen them before or saw how they're going to work, and they're some of them quite rapid fire as they go along. Is this somehow automated, or is somebody up there going to hit the right button for the sequence, or are you accompanying? Are you keeping the tempo according to the pictures?
We are accompanying what I see. Basically, once the concert starts, once the piece starts, somebody presses a button that says play, and it goes 33 minutes until it's done. And then the orchestra has to keep up and not get ahead.
Because often, I was actually the music reader one time for a television production with the Illinois Symphony, and I was the guy up in the booth who was cueing the cameras, you know, that they go to this shot. So this is how I imagined things would be done, but apparently not so.
No, it goes, and we have to keep up with it. And sometimes it's quite easy, And sometimes it's quite challenging. And basically, I have to just really memorize the sequence of photographs. And there is really no time to look at the score. So I just have to really just watch the photographs and conduct and hope it all comes out.
Good luck with that.
Thank you.
So when you did this in Rockford, did you use these same photographers or use different photographers?
No, we used a totally different idea, a consortium of eight photographers. Mm. And they submitted just samples of their work. And then we had somebody who just, we sat down and spent many months together putting together pieces and creating themes and formats and things like that and fades and deciding what's going to be used where. And we left that up to our photographers here to decide what was going to be used and put together their own themes.
And did you identify Larry Canfer and Carol Reckelin as the two to do this? Or
I didn't know either of them before this project, so I'm delighted to be working with them.
So who said, hey, these are the guys to use?
People who live down there here and know their work.
Well, Larry Canfer's work I've seen all over the place ever since I've lived here. Carol, I have to admit that if I've seen it, I wasn't aware of it, but I probably have seen it. Maybe partly because I go by Larry's gallery with great regularity. You're both graduates of the University of Illinois, so you've got a long-time connection here and have lived here since... We have that in common.
We came down to school
at least at some point and haven't left. I've been here for 20 years and you guys 40?
About 40.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Yeah. Well, congratulations. So Steve indicated the process here is backwards from the way Mussorgsky worked. He saw the pictures. He was inspired to write these various movements of the suite and he gave them each names after the drawings that he saw. Did you know the names of the drawings that were, or the movements, before you chose, or did you just hear the music and go that way?
We did a little research. We knew the names, and we looked at them, and we tried to get an idea of what we were going to do based on those names. But it's a little bit difficult to come up with images for, say, the hut on Fowl's legs. How would you do that?
Pretty or, scarce around here.
Yeah.
Or gnomes, or Baba Yaga. How would you do that?
The famous Russian witch.
Yes.
So we knew that.
You mean you didn't have any witch pictures in your gallery?
Well, or old castles. Yeah. I guess we had a few castles here and there, but no. So what we did was listen to the music over and over and over again and really had the inspiration from the music. How are we going to interpret this? And we spoke with Steve at length about how he feels about the music. And then we went back and listened again and again and again and came up with our different interpretations. I think in the end, we took several of the movements, each of us, did several of the movements independently, relatively independently, and then we did several movements where we both collaborated on the images, and those fit together really well. I think there's a nice synergy with our work.
And I have to say that Steve really gave us the ability to take it and run with it. I mean, he didn't tie us down at all creatively. He said he encouraged us to do what our soul thought it ought to do and interpret it the way we needed to interpret it and not follow what Rockford did or follow what his vision was. He really wanted us to take it and run with it ourselves. And that's what we've done.
I was looking at your websites a little bit and on Larry, your website, I noticed that I'm just going to quote you here. When someone looks at one of my photographs, I hope the image evokes some emotion. And you made reference to Steve's emotional response to some of the or psychological response to some of the music. So how did that figure in selecting some of these?
Well, that pictures? Just gave us a little bit of data points on how some people might see it. But in the end, we took it and tried to decide what what the images look like.
We sat down with Steve real early in the process. I mean, after we looked at the names and we weren't quite, it wasn't quite giving us enough information to get started, then we flew to Rockford and we met with Steve, and I actually watched him conduct every note. We went through every single note of the symphony, and we were watching for his reactions to certain notes so that we could see where he got, you know, where it was a big note and a lot of, was pulling something from his gut. And then there were times where the music would get really light. And so we, I think, got our first inspiration just by watching what he looked like as he conducted it in his head.
And some of the real little, the high notes were little, you know, little tiny things.
Little things like the water.
Like they're a drop of water. You know, it's just a little bit of sound, and there's a little drop of water. Then it goes into a big waterfall, and so there's a lot of sound.
So this is already your interpretation of the music.
Right.
Right.
Essentially, because I don't think there's any pictures of water in that he was inspired by.
Well, this whole piece, right from back to the very beginning, 1874, has been so remarkable. I mean, Mussorgsky was just such a strange genius, and this piano work he wrote was just like nothing that had ever been written before. Just totally, really unique in the real literal sense of the word. And almost immediately, certainly right after his death, people started orchestrating it. People looked at, they heard the music and thought, boy, this needs an orchestra. It just sort of cries out for color, for interpretation, for bigger resources. And I think there's at least a dozen published orchestrations of the piece. The best known, of course, is Maurice Ravel's. And in a way, this final result is almost as much Ravel as it is Mussorgsky, just the colors and that he's chosen, the orchestration. And it continues to invoke that response from people. Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, for instance, you remember in 1968 or 67, did their famous trio version of Pictures at an Exhibition. It hit rock stardom back then. It's no accident, I suppose, it's one of the most popular pieces of orchestral music ever written, because it just continues to have that kind of response in people. It just stimulates their imagination.
It's not incredibly difficult for the orchestra, but I hear it's astoundingly difficult for the pianist.
Yes. it's a real handful for the pianist to play this piece.
Which might be another reason that you hear it more often by orchestras than by pianists. Have you heard the piano version, by any chance, Larry and Carol?
No,
I haven't.
We should talk about this some other time if you ever get a chance to do that, because I can't imagine that you would have had the same inspiration from listening to it because the colors aren't there. In looking at your paintings, what I was able to sample, I mean, what I've seen of yours, Larry, over the years, and what I was able to sample, Carol, of yours on your website, you both, at least to my eye, have a similarity in that I'd say most of your pictures are very realistic. You know, they're pictures of things, you know, pictures of things that you can recognize, and they're beautifully composed and so on. Whereas not only the original drawings that inspired Mussorgsky, but especially his original music, I would say is more of the fantastic variety, fantastical, if you want. And I wonder how you found, if you found any difficulty reconciling that with the things that you do.
Because we do photorealistic kind of images and not abstract, we wanted this to flow but not be so specific that someone, you know, you talked earlier about, the emotion. We want to spark an emotion. We wanted people to kind of get a feeling about something but not say, oh, I was at this place specifically. And as you go through the whole, through all the movements, you want to get a flow but not color people by saying, oh, this is, you know, this spot is where I just drove by this intersection yesterday. So we have some known local images, but
They're not always recognizable. There are local images woven through almost every movement. In fact, I think they might be in every single movement. But some of them are so subtle, like there's the fireplace at the Virginia Theater, the detail in the fireplace. Well, that shows up in one of the movements. You'd have to really be watching. And so with 969 images in 35 minutes or 33 minutes, whatever it is, your eye is going to just be jumping from one to another. And so it'll be interesting to see what people remember when they walk out of there with so many images. There's going to be an art show before the concert. There'll be 12 canvases up, pieces that are both in the production and not in the production. So they'll be on display tomorrow night. There'll be a poster that they'll be selling for the symphony tomorrow night with some of the images from the production. And they're also going to sell pre-sell DVDs tomorrow night at the performance, so that anybody wants to have both the images and the CU Symphony playing this piece can actually order it and have one for themselves.
It's important to note that people who are watching this don't expect that there is going to be a story told in pictures. You know, there isn't a dramatic narrative in the photographs. You're best off just sitting back and looking and just letting, you know, the deeper part of your consciousness associate with images and just let it experience the whole totality and not to look for a thread, the dramatic thread going through.
Yeah, and there are some unexpected places in there that we tried to put in there that I think you'll be drawn.
Yeah, there are 15 different parts to this. And each one tells their own story. And so I don't think it's going to move really quickly from one to the next. And each one is really different. I mean, there's one that's really light and airy and whimsical, and then there's others that are really heavy and deep, and it feels like you're in a cemetery. And they're...
From our interpretation of the music, visually,
that's what we came up with.
So those are the end of one segment, the restatement of the promenade. And that theme by the trumpet, by the way, is supposed to represent more or less the composer strolling through the gallery where he was seeing these paintings of Victor Hartmann. This is music from Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, which will be played by the Champaign Urbana Symphony Orchestra tomorrow night, accompanying photographs by Larry Canfer and Carol Wackelin. This will be at the Kranitz Center for the Performing Arts, and we're having a conversation with the artists here on Live and Local. Here's a fun travel opportunity coming up in May. Fly to Washington, D.C. with WILL. You can come with us to the nation's capital and spend 4 days touring the city, including a stop at the NPR studios. Our trip will leave from Campbell Hall, which is the home of Illinois Public Media, on May 4th and return on May 9th. Call 217-333-7300 or visit our website, will.illinois.edu/willtravel for more information. So the segments that we just played, the Tuileries, which is a garden in Paris, and then the one that's called Bilo. Talk about the little frilly one first.
Well, Tuileries was actually the very first one we did. And it was, as Larry and I sat down and listened to these, we decided the best way to start would be to each take one. And so that one sounded light, whimsical, childlike to me. And because I've spent the last 30 years taking children's portraits, I figured that would be a good one for me to take. And so I did that, and I've called it Kids in Color since the very first day I started to work on it. And so I pulled together lots of really bright pictures. It's a combination of parts of sculptures in town and children's portraits and flowers and anything that was light and airy. And that's the first one we actually took. We ran it into a iPhoto program so we could put it to the music, and it seemed to work, and it got us jump-started into the next stuff.
Well, Steve mentioned that it's, you know, important to know that this doesn't tell a story necessarily as you go along, but also an interesting contrast between what Mussorgsky did and what you're doing is he had one picture that he had in mind inspiring his creativity for a whole movement. His whole movement inspires a whole ton of pictures from you guys. I think you said almost 1,000 photos going on during here, and you narrowed it down from twice that or something like that?
Yeah, I think of it as his picture is the heading for our paragraph.
Yeah.
Blessed excess.
Yeah. We're going to go out with one which is right before the final picture, which is the Great Gate of Kiev. But the one before that is called the Hut of... variously called the Hut on Fowl's Legs or the Hut on Chicken's Legs or the Hut of Baba Yaga, who is the Russian witch.
Right. We were that was the last piece that we really did, and we were sort of stuck for what were we going to do with this. We thought it sounded like strength, preparation and strength, and we didn't know what to do. Carol suggested, well, maybe it's something with sports. Maybe Alani. And then I thought, well, why not take the first? It's basically divided in three sections, the way I hear it. One is getting prepared for the battle, stretching and getting all set. Then there's a little a very light portion in the center, which, in my mind, is kind of showing the human form, which you know the just before the big battle, and then the final part is the battle. And this turns out that we went over and we photographed the Illini basketball game and for a portion of this, and we think it came out really well.
Most exciting parts of Pictures and Exhibition of Modest Mussorgsky. You can hear the whole piece played by the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Krannert Center in Urbana, with photographs by Larry Canfer and Carol Wackerlin. And Larry, Carol, and Steve Larson, the music director, have been my guests on this portion of Live and Local. Thanks very much for joining us on the show, and sounds like a grand time for the audience tomorrow.
Look forward to seeing you there.
Support for our show today comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector, the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com. This is 90.9 WYNL FM and HD Urbana, with translators W266 AF Urbana and W293 AF Danville, NPR Classical Music, and more for Central Illinois. It's a minute past one.